me, they didn't even touch my road until probably afternoon on Sunday. So a lot of snow. I don't like canceling church for weather, but it is what it is. Part of life, I guess, in Michigan. So it's been a week. We've had a week off since last time we had class, so hopefully that doesn't interrupt our flow too much, but I want to get started right away. You guys have in front of you a set of notes for lesson 269, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text. And we're going to be looking at the American text, 1840 and beyond, today in this lesson. If you're joining us on the live stream or would like to follow along, you can go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down under Recent Sermons, click the link for December 7th, and you can open the notes and follow along with us here as we get started. Okay. So again, we're at lesson 269, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, American Text, 1840 and beyond. In lesson 268 continued our exploration of the King James Bible in America, focusing on the development after the Revolutionary War and how American editions evolved in terms of printing, orthography, that's spelling, and distribution. Also, we consider the following points. Okay? First, we talked about post-revolutionary King James Bibles from 1783 to the year 1800. Four major editions were printed by Isaac Collins, 1789, Isaiah Thomas, 1791, Brown Family Bible, 1792, and Hugh Gaine, 1792. Concerns over textual accuracy led to petitions to Congress, but the First Amendment prevented government regulation of Bible printing. Remember, we talked about that, how the signing of the Bill of Rights, Congress refused to step in because it was viewed as being now an intrusion into religion. Okay, so you could debate whether that was the right thing or the wrong thing to do, but that's what happened. All right. So then we look secondly at Matthew Carey's editions. Carey printed a notable edition in 1801 after collating 18 different versions, and he identified orthographic and textual variations showing early American editions already diverged from British norms. Carey's 1813 edition reused standing type from his 1802-03 edition, originally purchased from Hugh Gaines. So remember, we made this point, right? That the 1813 Matthew Carey text answers to the 1802-1803 Matthew Carey text, which answers to the 1792 Hugh Gaines text because Matthew Carey bought the standing type from Hugh Gaines. All right? Then thirdly, we looked at stereotyping in the American Bible Society. Stereotyping was a printing method using reusable plates, and it revolutionized Bible production starting in 1812. The American Bible Society, founded in 1816, used this method to mass-produce Bibles, aiming to provide one for every American household. And we talked about they're printing hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these Bibles. Okay, and a lot of these American Bibles are then taken by American missionaries all around the world as that era, that great era of missions, occurred in the 19th century. And fourth, orthographic changes in American Bible Society text. American Bible Society editions, example 1816 and 1819, show spelling updates like established to established and alway to always. These changes reflected American spelling conventions and were not doctrinal alterations. By 1820, American Bible Society, the ABS, used 10 sets of plates with noticeably different spelling differences across editions. So they got 10 sets of plates capable of producing at least 3 different sized Bibles, and are they all identical to each other coming from the same press? No, they're not, right? So, in this lesson, we'll conclude our discussion of the American text by considering the following points, alright? So we're going to look at what some other people have said about this, alright? So far, we've been following what I've said in my book, The King James Bible in America, an orthographic, historical, and textual investigation. We've been primarily looking at things I said there in the prior two lessons. Now we're going to look at some other things that I didn't necessarily cover the same way in the book. Okay? So those are, number one, David Norton on the American text. Number two, Gordon Campbell on the American text. Lawrence Vance on American Bibles. And then some conclusions based on the American text is what we're going to be looking at. Okay, so let's stop there. Any comments or questions after the introduction slash review? Okay, so let's look at what David Norton says about the American text. Chapter 7 of Dr. David Norton's book, A Textual History of the King James Bible, is titled The Current Text. In this chapter, there is a subsection titled The American Text, in which Professor Norton offers some high-level observations regarding the text of the King James Bible in the United States in the 19th century. Quote, By the 1830s, the American Bible Society texts were serving as a model for other American publishers. In 1847, 30 years after the Society first expressed concern about the accuracy of its text, its board of members established a committee on versions to create its own standard. After 4 years' work, the committee recommended that the Octaval Reference Bible, now in the course of preparation, be adopted as a standard copy of the Society, to which all future editions published by the Society should be conformed, and presented a report giving some occasionally inaccurate history of the text and detailing the ongoing work. Now, I have my own copy of that report. That is this report right here. The report on the history and recent collation of the English version this is a copy of the report that was presented by the American Bible Society. I did read this and make reference to it at least once or twice in my book, The King James Bible in America. So this is a copy of the report. All right, moving on. The result was a fine quarto Bible, large enough to be a folio, published without the Apocrypha in 1856. In Herbert's catalog, it's H1904. It intended to be the standard American Bible Society text. The report itself was initially accepted, then rejected on ground of alleged want of constitutional authority and popular dissatisfaction with a number of changes made. So now you get into like parliamentary antics of the society, and they didn't follow the constitution of the society correctly, and so therefore, you know, the group of people are going to say, well, this isn't the standard one, and it gets really sort of muddled real quick, okay? Similarly, the 1856 Bible ran into trouble, mainly because of its work on the chapter summaries. A new committee was formed, changes were reconsidered, and new editions were produced, which did become the standard for 70 years. Nevertheless, it is the work of the first committee that is of the greatest interest, for the report gives the most substantial account of the work on the text so far published, and the 1856 text has real merits. Okay, so I'm not going to get into all of the nebulous junk regarding the ins and outs of the American Bible Society of the 19th century. That's sort of beyond what I want to talk about. It might be interesting for some people, but not necessary for what we were interested in covering here, okay? Fundamental to the edition was a collation of the Society's Royal Octavo edition with copies from four leading British editions, viz. Those of London, Oxford, Cambridge, and Edinburgh, and also with the original edition of 1611, and that's from the report, page 16. Okay, so if you get this report, you find that on page 16. The Oxford edition was Blaney's, so they looked at 1769, which has been regarded ever since its publication as the standard copy. So there is a statement from an American publisher that the Blaney text had been considered generally the standard copy. That's from page 10 of the report. Though this collation yielded nearly 24,000 variations in text and punctuation, not including the marginal summaries or headers, the committee declared there was not one which mars the integrity of the text or affects any doctrine or precept of the Bible. They say that on page 31. If Curtis, so this was Thomas Curtis, who we looked at a few weeks ago, a few lessons back, if Curtis would have been astonished by this, his apoplexy could only be imagined at the further declaration that the English Bible, as left by the translators, has come down to us unaltered in respect to its text, accepting changes of orthography, which the whole English language has undergone. That's from page 7 of the report. And similarly, the lesson of the 1833 reprint of the first edition, that typography errors and orthography accepted, quote, the text of our present Bible remains unchanged and without variation from the original as left by the translators. That's from page 11 of the report. The basis for this nonsense is that there are three kinds of variation: printer's errors in the 1611, printer's errors in subsequent editions, and other variations from the reading of 1611. Though the committee initially suggested that it was not always certain whether these last three were deliberate, after listing examples, it observed that they, quote, are also mostly, if not all, merely errors of the press, which have been corrected in later editions. That's page 11 and 14 of the report. The work of the editors, therefore, had been to rid the text of typographical errors. So Blaney's object had been to quote, restore the text of the English Bible to its original purity, and had he succeeded to as great a degree as he could as well be expected in any work of like event. Now, let's stop here, okay? So, is Norton agreeing with the report? Or is he taking issues with it? If you read it closely, Norton is taking some issues with this, because he's saying that the report is saying that the only categories of difference across all the editions that have ever been printed throughout history since 1611 till when this report was authored are like punctuation, spelling, and orthography. Okay? Now, we already know from our study, is that accurate? We know from our studies in the past that that's not accurate. Okay? So Norton is taking exception with the report. The policy of following the punctuation of the majority of their copies prevented innovation. Did I skip something?
Yeah.
Did I? Yeah, I did. My bad. So having collated its six texts, and without considering this, that its four modern texts might be Blaney's and three close representations of his work, the committee treated this unscholarly sample in a still more unscholarly way. So what he's saying there is they're claiming to have looked at all these historical printings, but what he's saying is they really are three of the ones they're looking at are really Oxford printings from Blaney. They're not necessarily this wide swath of historical printings. So Norton is taking issue with the methodologies that the committee was doing its work, the American Bible Society was doing its work. The committee treated this unscholarly sample in a still more unscholarly way, that is, it treated them democratically. The rule is adopted for variations in punctuation that, quote, uniform usage of any three of the copies should be followed. So in other words, if three of them had the same, then that was what they were going to go with. Okay? Appears to reflect a general practice which resulted in, quote, the great majority of instances in conformity with the modern English copies. If this is an unkind reflection on a huge project, the committee brought it on itself by obligating almost all signs of scholarly consideration of the accurate merits of the readings. Only five readings settled with reference to the original are noted under the innocent heading words. As far as the readings are concerned, what the committee offered was Blaney with his own 116 typographical errors removed. With its, quote, great and leading object being uniformity, it helped entrench the Oxford standard. So what Norton is saying is that the way these guys went about doing their committee work, do they basically ensure that whatever Blaney had from 1769 basically became the standard for the American editions? Now, you could debate whether that's good, bad, right, wrong, or indifferent, but that's what happened. All right? So the policy of following the punctuation of the majority of their copies prevented innovation and also worked against uniformity with any one of their copies. The result was an eclectic version of an 18th century punctuation. Nevertheless, the committee did good work in other areas, such as the chapter summaries, the regularization of names, something that now makes American Bible Society's Apocrypha strikingly different from British editions, and the spelling. This last is what catches the eye because it contains a significant number of changes that still need making to British editions. Now here's where this, so Norton is saying that one thing, in his opinion, this is his judgment, that one of the things the Americans did well is they regularized what? Spelling. Names and spelling. So did they further update? And then he says this same thing, he says it right there, bottom of the page. This last is what catches the eye because it contains a significant number of changes that still need making in British editions, including regularizing the use of A and N. Here are the main changes to words that still appear in an old form given in parentheses in British editions, an asterisk indicating those found in the 1856 text but not noted in the report. So look at page 4. Okay? So far, as we've looked at American editions, we've basically kept it to about four pairs of words. Alway and Always, End Sample Example, Establish, Establish, and Thoroughly, Truly. Okay, those are the pairs of words that I focused on when I wrote the King James Bible in America. But there's a whole bunch of other words. And we also saw, I should add, in the last lesson, lesson 268, we looked at 100 words, where 37 of those 100 words, the spelling had already been updated in American editions by 1816. Okay? But here's Norton's list. Okay? So anything that is not in parentheses indicates an American spelling. Anything in parentheses represents a British spelling. Now, I'm not going to read the whole list. Just talk about a couple, okay? Astonished versus
astonied,
I suppose, is the way you would pronounce it. Assuaged with a U-A-G-E-D versus assuaged, like the word wage with an E-D on it, right? So you've got all of these words, heretic with a C at the end, dropping the K. Havoc is spelled different. All of these words are adopted to American spellings in the American editions, and they are still in their old British spellings in British editions. Okay, so go to the bottom of that listing on page 4. American editions have been more inclined than the British to follow this example, but with no great thoroughness. Although the policy of the American Bible Society continued to be that spelling should be conformed to modern standards, it is a pity that the example was not generally followed, for then some unnecessary difficulty and appearance of antiquity would have been removed from the text a century and a half ago. So, is Norton dogmatizing on the spelling of words? Or is he saying these American spellings are equivalent to the British spellings, even though they're not spelled the same as the British editions? Okay? So, Norton is saying that the American editions actually carried the updating of the text further than what the British editions did. The British editions seem to have basically, for the most part, stalled out after Blaney in 1769. But when Americans started publishing the text, did they continue to Americanize spelling and update spelling of words, as not only this list demonstrates, but also the 100 words that I presented to you last week, or in the last lesson, lesson 268. So that's a good place to stop to see if anybody has any questions or comments. Any questions or comments?
On page 3, there was a couple of quotes there between Norton and when he's assessing the report.
Yes.
Okay, so in that, the report is talking about how orthography has changed. And the reprint of the first edition was that typographical errors in orthography accepted. The text of our present Bibles remains unchanged and without variation from the original copy as left by the translator. So, in what sense are they saying it's remained unchanged from the 1611? Just in doctrine, theology, thought?
That's a great question. I think generally that's what they mean. But they're basically, the argument basically they're advancing in the report is that it's sort of like a standard Cajo argument, right? That the only things that have really been changed are punctuation, spelling, and printer errors.
Right. So my point is that they don't see punctuation, orthography, stuff like that as damaging to the text and as essentially the same thing as the 1611.
That's what they're saying, yes.
So we're not to the standard KJVO language yet, because they're still seeing updating and orthography as perfectly acceptable.
And thus, the list on page 4 of them continuing to update the spelling.
Correct.
Yeah. Did you have a follow-up there?
No, just an interesting point.
Okay. All right, so bottom of page 4, Gordon Campbell on the American text. Professor Gordon Campbell also addresses the American text in Chapter 8 of his book, Bible, the Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011, that was published in 2010, titled The 19th Century. In order to avoid covering ground already discussed in prior lessons, we will be selective in our look at Campbell's comments. So if I quoted everything Campbell said, we'd be regurgitating a lot of stuff that we've already said. I didn't want to do that, so I was very specific in what I chose, okay? So, quote, starting the quote at the bottom of page 4, thereafter, and then I added the bracket. He's talking about Aiken's Bible, okay? Aiken's First American Printing. Aiken's unprofitable attempt to publish the King James Bible. See lesson 267 for details. So, thereafter, King James versions imported from England dominated the market. This pattern changed, however, when the American Bible Society, founded in 1816, the mightiest force in American Bible publishing, decided to prepare its own text. From the outset, members of the American Bible Society were concerned about the textual accuracy of its Bibles it was distributing, and Curtis's pamphlet, see lesson 266, fueled such anxieties. In 1847, the American Bible Society decided to address the problem by creating a standard American text of the King James Version. The process proved to be protracted. An edition was published in a large quarto format in 1856. This edition proved to be controversial, in part because of the chapters, its chapter summaries, and in due course, new committees were convened to consider revisions and publish yet another standard text. There is a fascinating account of the process whereby the American Bible Society attempted to stabilize the text in its report on the history of recent collations of English versions presented by the Committee on Versions to the Board of Directors of the American Bible Society, New York, 1851. And again, that's this book right here is my copy. Okay? Gotta love the way they titled things back in the day. The scholarly foundation of the process was a collation of six KJVs, its own earlier edition, the editions of Oxford and Cambridge, and two editions of the King's Printer in London and Edinburgh, and the text of 1611. The collation, which was undertaken by a Presbyterian minister called James MacLean, produced almost 24,000 variations in the text, including punctuation, but excluding apparatus in the margin and chapter summaries. So they didn't count those. At the end of the report, the members of the committee declared, in defiance of the discrepancies that they had identified, that, quote, the English Bible was left by the translators has come down to us unaltered in respect of its text, except in changes of orthography, which the whole English language has undergone. Apart from orthography, that is spelling and misprints, they concluded, quote, that the text of our present Bible remains unchanged and without variation from the original copy as left by the translators. So, Nate, that sort of reiterates your question.
Yeah, so again, there's, you know, I would disagree that this is a standard KJVO. They're not using it in that way.
No.
KJVO seems to have picked up on what they're saying and made it to mean something else. Because they're basically saying there are no changes in the text that we have in our printing that are substantial.
They seem to be saying something similar to some two people who wrote a book recently on this.
You're right. So they are basically claiming the text that we are going to put out in America is substantially the same as the 1611 in what it's affirming.
Correct.
They're not saying it's spelled the same. They're not saying it's punctuated the same. They're not saying it's italicized the same. But the text's message has remained the same and unaltered.
There's substantive doctrinal agreement
right.
Between.
So they're not saying what they're saying nearly as strict sense as the KJVOs have made it in the 20th century.
Correct.
21st century.
They are not. And they back that up by continuing to change orthography.
Correct.
Yeah. In the next paragraph, Campbell takes exception with these findings along the following lines. Quote, were the members of the committee asleep on the job, or perhaps not of the requisite caliber? The difficulty lay in the methodology with which they discharged their task. The Oxford text was Blaney's, and the other 19th century British texts were in varying degrees derivatives of Blaney's text. So he's saying they didn't really make a wide historical swath. Because they're comparing six texts, and four of them are all different iterations of whose text? Blaney's text, okay? The 1611 text was accorded no special authority, So in the principle that, quote, the uniform usage of any three copies should be followed was applied, the 1611 was outvoted by Blaney and its clones. The variations between the text and the understanding of the committee could be attributed to print errors, and its text was to eliminate those errors by the process of collation. Okay? So I think we got to be clear. The criticisms that Norton and Campbell are leveling against the committee report is that the committee report isn't necessarily what they're saying it is. They're saying it's this wide-scoping collation, but a bunch of the additions that they're including are all different modifications of the Blaney text. They're not looking at the text as it's coming down through history, through 1629 and 1638 and Scattergood in 1682 and so on and so forth. Okay, so they're saying there's some methodological problems in the way they conducted the collation. Campbell concludes this section by offering the following assessment of the American text. Quote, the result is a text that broadly reflects Blaney and its cousins, but with important differences occasioned by three factors. Scholarly scruple, the impetus to consistency, and the desire to use modern spelling. In the first case, the committee acknowledges a few changes, all centuries-old textual curses, that constitute a revision of the 1611 text. So setting aside the principle of following the consensus in Joshua 19:2, for example, the ABS text follows the 1611 in reading or Sheba instead of and Sheba in Ruth 3:15. ABS reads, she went, so preferring the literal sense of the contextual sense in it was Ruth who went, not Boaz, which we've talked about Ruth 3:15 in the past. In Song of Solomon 2:7, the ABS reads, nor awake my love till he please, instead of she please. This time preferring the contextual sense to the literal, the Hebrew verb is feminine. The pursuit of inconsistency led to regularization of indefinite articles a and an throughout. Though some anomalies, remain, especially in the vexed area of a definite article before a word beginning with H in Genesis 25:25, Esau has skin like an hairy garment, but in Genesis 27:11, he is said to be a hairy man. So, is he a hairy? You see where we get into extreme minutia, right? The third intention was to use modern spelling. Is the most obvious difference between the British and American texts of the KJV, because the former use 18th century spelling and the latter 19th century spelling. And I would add, in America. He doesn't say that. I would say that. All right? Because do the British still spell a lot of these words the same today? Yes. Okay? So, let me find my spot again. Because the former used 18th century spelling and the latter 19th century spelling, so in the ABS text, astonied becomes astonished, assuaged, W-A-G-E-D becomes assuaged, A-S-S-U-A-G-E-D, ought, O-U-G-H-T, becomes ought, A-O-U-G-H-T, and owl, all, A-U-L, becomes owl, A-W-L, and basin, B-A-S-O-N, becomes basin, B-A-S-I-N. The American text of the King James is altogether more modern than its British cousin. So, any comments or questions there before we move on?
Is it more modern for Americans or more modern? Period.
I don't know.
Would a Brit of the day call it more modern?
Would a Brit of the 19th century call it more modern? I think they would probably call it American.
Yeah.
those darn Yanks, look what they're doing to the Bible. That's probably what they would say. Something along those lines. Okay? But here's the point, okay? And when I say we, I mean Americans, when we start printing the King James Bible, do we start changing spelling to conform to the way Americans are advancing, different from the British? Everybody knows that we speak English and they speak English, but do we speak different forms of English? They speak more proper English, you know, all that sort of thing, right? But I was just there earlier this year. I can understand everybody just fine. We're all speaking what? English. Okay? Any other questions about what Campbell says before we look at Vance?
So really back then, this was more of a translation issue. Like, you're translating it, in a sense, into a different dialect, so to speak. Rather than being a British dialect of English, it's an American dialect of English.
I would generally think that's an acceptable way of saying it.
If you're going to put it into Italian, for example, you're going to take the same base text, put it into Italian. Are you not starting with the same base text and then putting it into a different dialect, so to speak, of English, like you might would with different dialects of Russian?
Yeah, I mean, I would say essentially what they're doing is they're Americanizing
the
text.
I think the problem is we don't see English as having dialects like you would with Russian or something like that. If you go over to the old Soviet Union, yes, a lot of them speak Russian, but there's different dialects of it throughout the different countries or even areas of Russia.
Yeah, I don't know that we don't see that, because if I go down south, they speak a different dialect than we do in Michigan.
We would in America, but we don't necessarily see it as, like, we don't think of the English language having multiple dialects.
Yeah, and if you read carefully the writings of a particular critic of mine out of Australia, you'll see that he spells words, even now, he spells words different than I spell words.
Right.
Okay, now, I'm prone to make spelling mistakes, but some of the ways words are spelled there are still spelled different than they are here.
Right.
Even in modern English. Okay. So Lawrence M. Vance on American Bibles. On pages 232 through 235 of his recently published The Text of the King James Bible, Dr. Lawrence M. Vance briefly addresses the topic of, quote, American Bibles. This subsection is found in Chapter 3, Editions of the Authorized Version. Over the last couple of lessons, we have cited and or referenced this source when it is pertinent or relevant to do so. As we wind down our discussion of the American text, I believe Dr. Vance's words are relevant to this discussion. Now again, Vance says a lot of stuff. He repeats some stuff that I've already said, so I didn't quote all that. Okay? This is towards the end of his section on the American text, and he says this, quote, "I have only mentioned three American publishers of modern King James Bibles." So he's not looking at historic printings. He's looking at more modern printings. Okay, Thomas Nelson, Word Bible Publishers, and American Bible Society are the ones that he mentions. Okay, there are many others. It would be impossible and profitless task to examine the text of every King James Bible they have published or currently publish. The problem in the United States is, as publisher HarperCollins, the parent company of Zondervan, states on its website under King James Version's KJV 1611 translation questions, quote, "There is no one standard KJV text, as this translation passes for public domain in the United States. Each publisher has made changes to the text to clarify archaic language for the modern reader." And what we have shown is that happened almost immediately, all the way back to 1792, if not, and in the first one by Aiken, as soon as Americans start to publish this text. So, where local church Bible publishers is wrong in their monograph, have you seen the changes that publishers are making to your King James Bible? American publishers are taking liberties with the text of the King James Bible is actually not a new thing. It goes all the way back to 1783 when the first Bible was printed in the United States. Is everybody following that? Okay? Finishing that quote. "For the text of the King James Bible published after 2000, Zondervan actually uses a modified King James text of the Cambridge Paragraph Bible edited by F.H.A. Scribner in 1783. The only King James Bibles published in the United States that can be recommended are those which follow a Cambridge standard. That's his opinion. The reason he's saying that is because as he's looked at the American printings, are they varying? He apparently doesn't like that to some degree, okay? I've already showed you guys. So this is my 1829, published at Massachusetts, all right? This is my 1877 Bible commemorating the 100th year anniversary of the United States. Got a huge Bible. And then I also have a 1920 American Bible Society edition. I believe this is a duodecimal or smaller. I haven't actually taken the measurements on it. Okay, but this text is published by the American Bible Society in 1920. If you look at it, it has the updated spellings of a bunch of these words.
Is that the full Bible?
The full Bible. The full Bible, all it has is basically the text. There's nothing else in it. Okay? So I'll leave that there for you if you want to look at that as well. Okay? So, this phenomenon is not new. This phenomenon is as old as the Bible being printed in the United States. All right? So before we look at the conclusion, does anybody have any questions or comments? Okay. The other thing I want to mention is in the King James Bible in America, since I'm going to talk about it here, at the end, there are tables comparing word usages of alway and always and sample and example, thoroughly, truly, that I've sampled some additions on. Okay, so here's what I sampled for this in the book. I started with the Aiken Bible. Okay? I started with the Aiken Bible. Then I looked at the American Bible Society from 1819. And Isaac Collins' 9th edition from 1828. The Edmund Cushing Bible that I have from 1829. Okay? Then I looked at an American Bible Society from 1838. The Self-Interpreting Bible from 1859. I looked at Harding's Fine Edition from 1863. Holman's Edition from 1875. And last, the Illustrated Family Reference Bible from 1877. So what I did there is I intentionally selected a sampling of Bibles. I couldn't look at every single one of them. I don't have access to every single one of them. But I looked at a sampling of Bibles across a wide swath of decades of the 19th century. Okay? And all of them have differences in orthography and the way that they are spelling the four pairs of words that are centrally focused on as test cases in the King James Bible in America. Okay? So the conclusion here to the lesson is, I want you to read the note. The content of this section with a few changes is taken from my book, The King James Bible in America, Orthographic, Historical, and Textual Investigation, published by Dispensational Publishing House in 2019. Look at point number one. Much more could be said about the textual history of the King James Bible in America between 1777 and 1881. Or just in general, obviously. Vance himself said it would be pointless to try to look at every edition. Because you're just going to keep finding stuff. Okay? So, much more could be said about the textual history of the King James Bible in America between 1777 and 1881. I picked 1881 because that's the year that the Revised Version is published in England. And the Westcott and Hort Critical Greek Text is published. That's beyond the scope of this lesson. Our main purpose has been to address a particular aspect of how King James' position is messaged, discussed, and propagated by its supporters. I believe it is detrimental to the integrity of the position to say things that cannot be supported by historical and or textual facts. The truth does not benefit from rhetoric, no matter how well intended, that can easily be proven wrong by a better command of the relevant facts. King James Bible believers have enough challenges as it is without adopting positions that expose our flanks to further attack. Okay? From its inception in 1611, the King James text has undergone orthographic change. This process is acknowledged as normal progression in the development of language. Consequently, differences in spelling conventions are anticipated and expected when comparing the text of 1611 with the standard King James text of 1769. Yet no King James Bible believer views this reality as detrimental to their position. Is everybody with me so far? Next point. It is commonly held that the only differences that exist between the 1611 and the 1769 texts are, number one, the corruption of clear printer errors, two, updates in orthography or the spelling of words, and three, changes in punctuation as English grammar became more settled. Yet, as was demonstrated throughout our discussion of the printed history of the text, this notion is incorrect and does not accord with the facts. Wording differences beyond printer errors and spelling do exist between the various editions of the King James Bible. It is here that we must recognize that there is a difference between, one, a different way of saying the same thing, and two, a substantive difference in meaning. The wording differences that exist between the 1611 and the 1769 King James text fall into the first category, i.e., they are not substantive. They are different ways of saying the same thing and do not undermine the doctrinal integrity of the text while at the same time not exhibiting identical wording. If one does not allow for different ways of saying the same thing and insists upon verbatim identicality of wording, they would be forced to declare which edition of the King James is the inerrant one to the exclusion of all, to the exclusion of the others. Now folks, I don't know. Maybe I fell off the turnip truck too soon, but that's a logical. If you're going to say, I don't care which one it is, X edition is the inerrant one, pick your favorite one, then that means that anything that doesn't agree with that exactly is deficient. Yeah?
Didn't you claim verbatim identicality? Wouldn't you have to throw away all English translations to go back to the Greek and Hebrew? Because that's verbatim identical.
Yeah, I would say...
Yes, if you're going to be strict. No, if you want to have your cake and eat it too.
Which there's a lot of. And even if you go back to the Greek with the verbatim identicality, then you run into the same question, which Greek? Because there are different editions of the TR that have minor differences from each other, and the original autographs are lost, and so the only way to know that you have absolutely verbatim, exact identicality, Xerox identicality, is if we still had access to the original parchments written by Paul and James and Luke, which we don't have. We have copies. Okay? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So again, with this last paragraph, it seems like when they're talking about orthography and punctuation changes and stuff like that, it seems like they don't have the same concept that modern people have today about the jot and tittle sort of thing. It doesn't seem like they see a different wording, like we've shown with the, what was the one from Jane, Jude, or whatever?
Whether you have both or not both?
Correct. It doesn't seem like they understand that as a difference. It's not like they're looking at that saying, hey, that's an editorial choice. They don't really even bring that into the discussion.
Yeah.
It's not even worth discussing to them back then.
Their view of it is much different than the view of King James only people today.
Right.
Because they weren't living in the same historical milieu that we are living in now with everything that's happened since 1881.
Well, I mean, German higher criticism wasn't a thing yet, or at least not popular yet.
Right.
In these early English editions. And even when German higher criticism became a thing, it would take a while to trickle over to America.
And then trickle down from academia into pulpits and churches and so on and so forth. Yeah, it takes a while. So did you have a...
No, it's just like, even with what they're saying back then, like people might be able to point to it and see, they're only saying there's spelling differences and stuff. But what they're including in that doesn't seem to be the same as what modern advocates are trying to say. So, like, yeah, it is that historical... What is it? The historical...
Chronological snot or
presentism.
It
seems to be a lot of presentism where you're reading back into what their statements are, stuff that's post-textual high criticism, and you're taking post-high criticism, German higher criticism, and then reading it back into the statements of these early printers and acting like they're saying the same thing as modern advocates.
You are what you're doing is you're taking the relevant points in a doctrinal theological debate in the late 20th, early 21st century now, and you're then taking that and reading it back into a more than 150-year-old historical context where those people knew nothing about the same types of things that we're currently debating. And then lifting that stuff out of a historical context and saying, see, these guys back here agreed with us. They agreed exactly with the way that we're representing things now.
Right. So yeah. They were more concerned, does the text agree with the 1611 and its content? Not necessarily orthography.
Correct.
Revelation, jot, tittle stuff. They don't even care about the jot, tittle stuff. They just want to know, is the text we're reading in 1800 essentially the same text as the 1611?
Right. And that's where I would say that, like, certain folks like to accuse me all the time of being a modernist.
Right.
Okay? I'm actually not a modernist, because what I'm saying is we need to go back to the way this stuff was viewed back then.
Right.
Look at the next point.
And this is prior to German higher criticism coming to America.
Like, way before.
Right. So
like,
pre-modern.
A lot of this discussion is even before Codex Sinaiticus is even discovered.
Right.
Or they even know that it exists.
Right.
So, yeah, it's you got to be careful with how you take how you handle the historical context. So look at the next point. Once the insistence upon the standard of verbatim identicality is broken, one is free to evaluate the nature of each variant encountered responsibly and ascertain the nature of the difference. Herein lies the distinction between the various editions of the King James and modern versions. The editions of the King James do not differ substantively despite not possessing verbatim wording. In contrast, modern versions and their underlying Greek texts have changed the wording so drastically that they have altered the substantive doctrinal content of the text. Okay? But where was I? Modern versions err because they report information that is false, whereas the King James Bible does not, because the doctrinal integrity of the readings is uncompromised despite the lack of verbatim identicality. Or verbatim wording. Once this lesson is learned, one can evaluate the various differences in orthography present in the King James text honestly. If words such as truly and thoroughly can be proven to have the same meaning, then it would be a mistake to call all editions of the King James Bible that change the spelling of these words corruptions. Words such as all way and all ways, or ensample and example, or establish and establish, are not wholly different words of completely different meaning, but alternative spellings of the same word. You guys understand what I'm saying here? Okay? Continued orthographical updates to the King James text beyond 1769 occurred in America from the inception of the printed history of the text in the United States, 1782. As early as 1792, the spelling of words such as throughly was changed to thoroughly, not as part of, quote, a new attempt to corrupt the King James Bible, but in an effort to conform the text to American spelling conventions. These changes were being made at a point in history, and this is what Nate was just bringing up, made at a point in history when the King James text was not in dispute or being challenged by modern versions. Codex Sinaiticus had not even been discovered yet, and it would be nearly another 30 years before the publication of the Westcott and Hort Greek text and the Revised Version of 1881.
90.
What'd I say?
30 years.
My bad. I meant 90.
Oh, that's
true. 30 is true. So. Okay. And by the way, I have another book here. Look at this. An Apology for the Common English Bible. Okay. They're calling the King James Bible the common what? English Bible. Why are they calling it the common English Bible?
Because it was.
It was the Bible everybody had. It was the Bible everybody used. Imagine going to church and not having to go through a Bible version debate before you can even preach. But that's where we're at now. My Bible doesn't say that. My Bible says this. And, you know, you've got this whole now extra layer of nonsense to get through before you can even exegete a text because of all of this stuff. Okay? So what I'm saying is that the stuff that we're talking about occurred before all this controversy. Alright? Next point. The King James Bible was never printed with uniformity in North America. And it still isn't. Okay? Nearly every American edition possessed some sort of orthographical variant. Now here's the point. If one is going to persist in the position that editions containing different orthography are, quote, corruptions, then they would be forced to conclude that generations of American Christians did not possess the pure Word of God. My wife's family Bible, 1877, does not agree in the way it spells words with Bibles from Cambridge and Oxford. If you're going to say that it has to be a certain way, then you're going to have to logically say that this is an illegitimate what? Bible. If that's the standard, then you got to apply the standard consistently across the various editions. Nate?
You're right. And the common response to that is to play a game of semantics.
Yes.
And say, well, they contain the Word of God.
Which is the same semantics the modern version crowd plays.
Correct. And it's not helpful because we know that there are only two options. When I ask of whatever book I'm holding, is this the Word of God? There are only two acceptable answers logically. Yes, it is, or no, it's not. If I try to semantically bypass that and make more options, like, well, it contains the Word of God. Well, then it's not the Word of God. So, yeah, you can try to sidestep the issue all you want, but at the end of the day, it either is the Word of God or it's not the Word of God.
And if you adopt that thinking, you would have to falsify, I'm just going to say, millions of Bibles printed, King James Bibles printed in America, because they don't match British orthography.
Right.
Americans accepted these Bibles, they believed these Bibles, they were the common English Bible, they sent these Bibles all around the world by their missionaries, and so on and so forth. It does not make any sense to me why you would want to adopt a position that logically leads to the falsification of all these Bibles. Simply because you think it has to be spelled a certain way.
Well, okay, but then stay in that position. Like a good modernist, stay in the position that everything just contains the Word of God.
So who's the modernist?
Correct. That's the modernist take. All
yeah.
The other ones contain the Word of God, but are not the pure Word of God.
Excellent point. So, back to the notes. So we read the paragraph about the King James never being printed with uniformity, right?
Yeah.
Okay, next paragraph. Is this really the conclusion that King James Bible believers desire to reach? Do we really want to say that generations of American Christians possess, quote, corrupt King James Bibles because they did not come from an Oxford or Cambridge University press? Is it our position that in order to possess the, quote, pure Word of God in English, one must possess a particular printing from a particular press produced on a particular continent? You understand that's exactly what people are saying, though. There's a prevalent gentleman online who's basically saying that exact thing. Okay? We'll be looking at his position in the near future. In reality, the historical and textual facts are messier than we have heretofore realized. Out of our ignorance of the facts regarding the printed history of the King James Bible in America, King James Bible believers have adopted positions that functionally impose our present textual and translational controversies upon bygone generations of Americans who knew nothing of the challenges we face today, to the point Nate raised earlier. For them, the text of the Bible was never in dispute. Everyone clung to the standard of the King James, the Common English text, i.e. the King James Bible. And again, that's this, an apology for the Common English Bible, right? Just to show you that language was being used quite frequently, particularly in the United States, to refer to the King James Bible. And that makes sense, right? I mean, you know, these Americans don't want to be running around necessarily and referring to the King's Bible. So, because, you know, we broke away from the king, so they call it the common what? The common English Bible, which is what it was. It was common. It's the Bible everybody had. Everyone clung to the standard of the common English text, i.e. the King James Bible. It never occurred to them that they might not have God's preserved word if they did not possess a Bible printed on an Oxford or Cambridge University press, assuming one was even available to them. They just believed that whichever copy of the King James Bible they were fortunate enough to possess was the Word of God and allowed it to work in them effectually. So, the entire The entire process of researching and preparing these lessons has been an eye-opening and sobering experience. Much of what has been written in pro-King James literature in defense of this position possesses a superficial appeal, but is nonetheless incorrect. As King James Bible believers, we need to make sure that we are applying the Berean principle, Acts 17:11, to our position on the Bible and searching things out to make sure they are so. Empty, unsound, and incorrect rhetoric does not help our position. It harms it. Therefore, it is incumbent upon believers who stand for the infallibility of the King James Bible to enunciate a position which is accurate and in accordance with the historical and textual facts. So, we have about 5 minutes, four minutes or so, if anybody has any questions or comments. Nate?
I don't think it can be overstated about that this is happening before modernism has attacked the veracity of English Bible. This has not been applied. Modernistic presuppositions have not yet been applied to the text of the King James Bible through German higher criticism in the late 19th century. So, I don't think you can overstate how huge that is for this modern debate, because exactly what you and I both have been accused of constantly lately, of being modernists, does not make any sense, because this is all being taught before modernism ever was applied to the text of the Bible.
Correct. Indeed, and we're seeing it already in the late 18th century and the early 19th century in American Bibles before the modernist controversy hit academia, before it hit before it came to the United States in the late 1800s by Warfield and Hodge.
Well, even the other opinions don't have, Freudian psychology based on Heidel's dialecticalism and stuff isn't even becoming a thing. I mean, Freud was right at the turn of the 20th century. So even that understanding, which is the underpinnings of the German higher criticism, doesn't even come into play yet.
Evolution, Darwin doesn't write his book until 1859.
Which is also birthed out of Freudian psychology and Heidel's dialecticalism. So you're not even getting the basis for modernism yet.
Right. I totally agree. Any other questions or comments?
Does the American version have an influence because of all the melting of German, Irish, Dutch that come in?
I mean, there might have been, there might have been, like, influences on American spellings because through immigration.
I mean, if you're in England, everybody's English.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's why, but even within English itself, were words being updated in orthography all the way since 1611. So to continue to modernize the spelling of a word, what are you doing fundamentally different there than what happened already that every King James advocate already accepts between 1611 and 1769? So.
Well, to Bart's point, there's clearly a difference between American English and British English at the time, outside the conversation of the Bible itself. Like, clearly there's something different about the American English and British English at that time, just generally.
Right. So we're not talking here about people who are trying to just update it to make it easier to read. They're talking about and like structurally changing it and taking verses out or doing this or that. All we're talking about is somebody taking a word and spelling it with a different spelling. But the situation as it exists today is such that there are people that will say, if you change the spellings of any of these words, you have corrupted the text. And if you don't believe me, read the monograph put out by Local Church Bible Publishers, because that is essentially the main thesis of the monograph. So,
I think those people have no idea how translation from one language to another occurs. I mean, it cannot be word for word, for one thing.
That could be part of the problem. The other part of the problem is they have no idea of the history of the text in America. Because if they did, they wouldn't say this stuff, because it started, as I've demonstrated amply, as early as 1782. Right? So, next week, we are going to talk about the Cambridge Paragraph Bible from 1873, and then we're going to start looking at a more of a modern view on this as we look at the Pure Cambridge Edition. So, we'll take any comments or questions. I got to close down the stream and clean up the equipment.
I did look up online.